everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm on the road and therefore not in studio. Hopefully at some point during the program we'll be able to make a connection to the microphone and it'll be a little clear audio. In the interim, today's program is devoted to a reexamination of the Clinton campaign and what she stands for. What would you be getting if she were elected? In part, we have to take a look back at the Clintons because they were a co-presidency. They would be again. And we have to ask ourselves, do we really benefit as a nation by having these two people in power? I will not be sharing my own views. Instead, I'll be sharing the views of Sarah Lazar and Max Blumenthal from Global Research on the Clintons earned over $3.5 million in paid addresses to pro-Israeli organizations. So that tells us where they stand on trying to resolve the Palestinian conflict. It wouldn't happen. From Simon Head of the New York Review of Books, The Clinton System. We'll also be looking at Hillary Clinton, a deplorable choice for president, the most dangerous of the bunch, from Stephen Ledman from the Progressive Radio Network. Another Hillary falsehood, she did not tell banks to cut it out. Pre-Christ, she blamed homeowners. And
from Naked Capitalism. Also today, Hillary the Hawk and her Middle East policy. This is a longer one by Stephen Zunis, and we will look at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs. Also today, we will look at Hillary's Secret War by Andrew Napolitano, providing material assistance to terrorists, as well as David Ciorda from Salon.com, the Clinton Foundation's business relationship with 20 foreign governments raises real questions about her judgment. And it depends upon how much time we have as to how much we'll be able to share. Again, these are all others' opinions. And why am I doing this particular hour? It's simple. The New York Times endorsed Clinton. I did not see any of the caveats on what was their concern. These are all very serious concerns. She has a legacy, and that legacy should be explored. But it isn't. Most of the left and all of the corporate left and liberal establishment has embraced her. A short comment before I begin. Years ago, when the Clintons were first running for the presidency, I was invited by a close friend of mine to a dinner that this person was having as a fundraiser for the Clintons. My friend is a very prominent New Yorker, very wealthy, and said, "You'll really enjoy it." What my friend did not know is that I had been looking at the illegal drug trades in Mena, Arkansas, and all the background on Clinton involvement in this. I did not mention this to my friend. Instead, I simply ask a question. Who's going to be at this fundraiser and why? And without hesitating, he said, "Well, New York's most powerful shaker and makers, as well as those in Washington, D.C., will probably have around 100 people all told throughout the evening. And these people are bundlers, meaning they can write big checks. They represent Wall Street. They represent real estate in New York. They represent segments of the military-industrial complex." He was going on through who his friends were. I knew none of these people. And I asked him, I said, "Well, do you feel that it's right that he is going to be taking money from industries that he would then be beholden to?" And my friend shrugged and said, "That's the way politics has always been." I chose not to go to that dinner. I chose not to put my friend in a position to embarrass him because I knew enough about the Clintons to know I do not respect them. But that is based upon what I have seen of their activities. Now, if I can find these things out about them, so too could all of the other liberal institutions, the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, and their host. So these are smart people. They have lots of resources. They're all interconnected in one dimension or another, so it wouldn't be difficult for them to find the truth if they wanted it. And therefore, I feel that the rest of the public should know the truth, because you're not going to get it in most of the media. Let's begin with Sarah Lazar and Max Blumenthal from Global Research. Most of these are short pieces, but they're very telling. All of these are posted on our website. And I want to thank the 653,000 people who've come to our site in the last 24 hours to download and read information and to share it. Quote, Bill Clinton said he could grab a rifle and fight for Israel during a paid speech. Bill and Harriet Clinton are under increasing scrutiny from the mainstream press over paid speeches they have given to big banks in exchange for millions of dollars. According to one report, the couple have earned $153 million in lecture fees from companies and organizations affiliated with the financial industry. But the media has been conspicuously silent about the large sums the Clintons have raked in from paid addresses to pro-Israeli organizations, including the Jewish National Fund, which directly participates in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and Bedouin citizens of Israel. An evaluation of Hillary Clinton's public disclosures from 2001 to 2015 show that she and Bill and their daughter Chelsea have earned roughly $4 million in speaking fees from pro-Israeli organizations, including the Jewish National Front and organizations allied with the right-wing government, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The vast majority of these document payments, $3,599,999, have gone towards the Clintons' personal income, and up to $450,000 has been funneled into the Clinton Foundation. Rama Kadami, membership outreach coordinator for the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation, told Alternate, quote, it is the right of voters to know what every single candidate earns in speaking fees, whether from banks or pro-Israeli groups that engage in oppressive policies against Palestinians. It is the voters' right to know if we have candidates running to be president who plan to continue horrific U.S. policies that make us all complicit in Israel's denial of Palestinian rights. Bill Clinton's presidency ended with the collapse of the U.S.-led peace process at Camp David. After leaving office, Clinton publicly blamed Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat for the failure of negotiations, explicitly violating a promise he made to Arafat at the start of the Camp David process. The former president thus reinforced then-Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak's infamous talking point that there was, quote, no Palestinian partner for peace. Bill Clinton declared in the summer 2002 at a Toronto chapter of the pro-Israeli group, WISO, quote, if Iraq came across the Jordan River, I would grab a rifle and get in the trench and fight and die, reportedly earning wild applause from attendees at a $1,000 a plate dinner. According to a New York Post reporter in attendance, Clinton again blamed Palestinians for his failure at Camp David, quote, accusing Arafat of making a disastrous mistake by turning down past peace proposals that would have given the Palestinian leader control of 97% of the West Bank, end quote. Clinton received $125,000 for that speech. Bill Clinton received $425,000 for two speeches to Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, a right-wing group that generally supports the Likud-run government of Benjamin Netanyahu and is hostile to Democrats. Simon Wiesenthal Center president, who addressed the 2000 Republican National Convention, has compared President Barack Obama to Neville Chamberlain and described the Iran nuclear deal, quote, as another Munich. In 2011, 3 years before Bill Clinton's second paid speech before the organization, he accused then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton of, quote, of a sellout to anti-Semitism for opening diplomatic discussions with Egypt's democratically elected president. While unmentioned in public discussions, the Clinton Foundation website notes that the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, the main arm of the America's pro-Israeli lobby, contributed up to $25,000 to the organization for at least one speech delivered by Bill Clinton, with the exact date or amount paid unspecified. S. David Abraham, the slim fast diet mogul who serves on the board of AIPAC, has given as much as $5 million to the Clinton Foundation through a series of front groups, ad campaigns, and Israeli propaganda tours for freshman members of Congress. AIPAC spent upwards of $40 million just last year in a failed attempt to derail the Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal. Among the Clintons' pro-Israeli speaking fees, only one was received from an organization that could be classified as part of Israel's peace camp, the Abraham Fund, which says its aim is to promote coexistence and equality among Jewish Israelis and Arab-Palestinian citizens. It paid $125,000 for a single speech in 2002. Chelsea Clinton raked in as much as $325,000 in speaking fees in the United Jewish Appeal and its affiliate, the Jewish Federations, a pro-Israeli umbrella group of Jewish American establishment organizations that actively combats the Palestinian-led BDS, which is a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. She remits 100% of her speaking fees to the Clinton Foundation, where she's a board member and helps decide how the foundation's speaking fees spends its $180 million annual budget. Bill Clinton took in six-figure lecture fees from pro-Israeli synagogues around the country. Our calculations include only Jewish institutions whose pro-Israeli programming could be identified. We excluded hundreds of thousands of dollars in speaking fees paid to the Clintons by Jewish institutions whose online materials do not explicitly promote Israel. In addition, Bill Clinton received $250,000 for a speech to Univision Management Company, the media corporation co-owned by pro-Israeli billionaire Haim Saban, as Alternet's Gray Zone project recently reported. Saban and his wife Cheryl contributed $5 million to the pro-Hillary Clinton Super PAC Priorities USA action this February, and Saban has also contributed upward to $10 million to the Clinton Foundation. Public records show that Bill Clinton earned a total of $549,000 for four individual speeches, and the disclosures do not mention the most generous fee. The Jewish National Front provoked an outcry within pro-Israeli circles when it transferred $500,000 to the Clinton Foundation through a Perez Academic Center to pay for a single speech by Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton later said he donated his large fee back to the Perez Academic Center, but there are lingering questions about where all the money went, including funds from the JNF. Formed in 1901, the Jewish National Front has spent over a century driving Palestinians off their land, including through the creation of the paramilitary forces euphemistically known the Green Patrol. Former JNF director Yosef Weitz outlined detailed plans for a mass ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in 1948, demanding their villages be destroyed and they, quote, be harassed continually to prevent them from returning. In recent years, JNF has teamed up with the Israeli military police and Christian Zionist donors to expel the residents of unrecognized Bedouin villages in Israel's Negev Desert. And Hillary Clinton has made her unflinching support for Israel a centerpiece of her foreign policy agenda. She promised recently to reaffirm the unbreakable bond with Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting she would adopt a friendlier posture to Israel's right-wing leader than Obama had. In fact, in a letter in July of 2015 to mega donor Haim Saban, which her campaign distributed to the press, Clinton declared, quote, "We need to make countering BDS a priority." It was the first time in American history that a presidential candidate mentioned by name the grassroots movement to boycott Israel. As the challenge to her primary candidacy from Senator Bernie Sanders grows, Hillary Clinton is tacking left. During her concession speech in New Hampshire, Clinton insisted to local supporters, quote, "I believe so strongly that we have to keep up with every fiber of our being the argument for the campaign for human rights." Whether Clinton presidency would alter the U.S.-Israeli special relationship remains to be seen. And then we go now to another report And this one is from Andrew Napolitano. It's a short piece. It's entitled Hillary's Secret War, Providing Material Assistance to Terrorists. In the course of my work, I'm often asked by colleagues to review and explain documents and statutes. Recently, in conjunction with my colleague, Catherine Herridge, our chief intelligence correspondent, and Pamela Brown, our senior executive producer, I read the transcript of an interview Brown did with a man named Mark Turry, and Herridge asked me to review emails to and from State Department and congressional officials during the years when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. What I saw has persuaded me beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty that Clinton provided material assistance to terrorists and lied to Congress in a venue where the law required it to be truthful. Here's the backstory. Turry, this T-U-R-I, is a lawfully licensed American arms dealer. In 2011, he applied to the Department of State and Treasury for approvals to sell arms to the government of Qatar. Qatar is a small Middle Eastern country whose government is so entwined with U.S. government that it almost always will do what American government officials ask it. In its efforts to keep arms from countries and groups that might harm Americans and American interests, Congress has authorized the Department of State and Treasury to be arms gatekeepers. They can declare a country or a group to be a terrorist organization, in which case, selling or facilitating the sale of arms to them is a felony. They also can license dealers to sell. Turry sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of arms to the government of Qatar, which then, at the request of American government officials, were sold, bartered, or given to rebel groups in Libya and Syria. Some of the groups that received the arms were on the U.S. terrorist list. Thus, the same Treasury and State Department that licensed the sale also prohibited them. How could that be? That's where Clinton's secret State Department and her secret war came in, because Clinton used her husband's computer server for all of her email traffic while she was the Secretary of State, a violation of three federal laws. Few in the State Department outside her inner circle knew what she was up to. Now we know. She obtained permission from President Obama and consent from congressional leaders in both houses of Congress and in both parties to arm rebels in Syria and Libya in an effort to overthrow the governments of those countries. Many of the rebels Clinton armed, using the weapons lawfully sold to Qatar by Turry and others, were terrorist groups who are our sworn enemies. There was no congressional declaration of war, no congressional vote, no congressional knowledge beyond fewer than a dozen members, and no federal statute that authorized this. When Senator Ron Paul asked Clinton at a public hearing of the Senate Armed Service Committee on January 23, 2013, whether she knew about American arms shipped to the Middle East, to Turkey, or any other country, she denied any knowledge. It is unclear whether she was under oath at the time, but that is legally irrelevant. The obligation to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to Congress pertains to all witnesses who testify before congressional committees, whether an oath has been administered or not. Here is her relevant testimony. Paul, my question is the United States involved with any procuring of weapons, transfer of weapons, buying, selling, anyhow, transferring weapons to Turkey out of Libya? Clinton, to Turkey? I will have to take that question for the record. Nobody's ever raised that with me. Paul, it's been in news reports that ships have been leaving from Libya and that they may have weapons. And what I'd like to know is, the Benghazi annex that was close by, were they involved with procuring, buying, selling, obtaining weapons? And were any of these weapons transferred to other countries, any countries, Turkey included? Clinton, Senator, you will have to direct that question to the agency that ran the Benghazi annex, and I will see what information is available. Paul, you are saying you don't know? Clinton, I do not know. I don't have any information on that. At the time that Clinton denied knowledge of the arms shipment, she and her State Department political designee, Andrew Shapiro, had authorized thousands of shipments of billions of dollars worth of arms to U.S. enemies to fight her secret war. Among the casualties of her war were Ambassador of to Libya, Chris Stevens, and three colleagues, who were assassinated at the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, by rebels Clinton armed with American military hardware in violation of American law. Now, this secret war and the criminal behavior that animated it was the product of conspirators in the White House, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the Justice Department, the CIA, and a tight-knit group of members of Congress. Their conspiracy has now unraveled. Where is the outrage among the balance of Congress? Hillary Clinton lied to Congress, gave arms to terrorists, and destroyed her emails. How much longer can she hide the truth? How much longer can her lawlessness go unchallenged and unprosecuted? Does she really think the American voters will overlook her criminal behavior and put her in the White House where she can pardon herself? Now we're going to take an examination of the Clinton Foundation. This is from David Sorda from Salon.com. The article is entitled "The Clinton Foundation's Business Relationship with 20 Foreign Governments Raises Real Questions About Her Judgment." Among all the rivers of money that have flowed to the Clinton family, one seems to raise the biggest national security question of all. The stream of cash that came from 20 foreign governments who relied on weapons export approvals from Hillary Clinton's State Department. Federal law designates the Secretary of State as, quote, responsible for the continuous supervision and general direction of sales of arms, military hardware, and services to foreign countries. In practice, that meant that Clinton was charged with rejecting or approving weapons deals. And when it came to the Clinton Foundation donors, Hillary Clinton's State Department did a whole lot of approving. While Clinton was Secretary of State, her department approved $165 billion worth of commercial arms sales to Clinton Foundation donors. That figure, from Clinton's three full fiscal years in office, is almost double the value of arms sales to those countries during the same period of George W. Bush's second term. The Clinton-led State Department also authorized $151 billion of separate Pentagon-brokered deals for 16 of the countries that gave to the Clinton Foundation. That was a 143% increase in completed sales to those nations over the same time frame during the Bush administration. The 143% increase in U.S. arms sales to Clinton Foundation donors compares to an 80% increase in such sales to all countries over the same time period. American military contractors and their affiliates that donated to the Clinton Foundation, and in some cases helped finance speaking fees to Bill Clinton, also got in on the action. Those firms and their subsidiaries were listed as contractors in $163 billion worth of arms deals authorized by the Clinton State Department. Under a directive signed by President Clinton in 1995, the State Department is supposed to take foreign governments' human rights records into account when reviewing arms sales. Yet Hillary Clinton's State Department increased approvals of such deals to Clinton Foundation donors that her own agency was sharply criticizing for systematic human rights abuses. As just one of many examples, in its 2011 Human Rights Report, Clinton's State Department slammed Algeria's government for imposing, quote, restrictions on freedom of assembly and association, tolerating arbitrary killing, widespread corruption, and a lack of judicial independence. That year, the Algerian government donated $500,000 to the Clinton Foundation, and the next year, Clinton's State Department approved a one-year, 70% increase in military export authorizations to the country. The jump included authorizations for almost 50,000 items classified as toxicological agents, including chemical agents, biological agents, and associated equipment. The State Department had not authorized the export of any such items to Algeria the year before. During Hillary Clinton's 2009 Senate confirmation hearings, Republican Senator Richard Lugar said the Clinton Foundation should stop accepting foreign government money. He warned that if it didn't, quote, foreign governments and entities may perceive the Clinton Foundation as a mean to gain favor with the Secretary of State. The Clintons did not take his advice. Advocates for limits on the political influence of money now say that Lugar was prescient. Quote, the word was out to these groups that one of the best ways to gain access and influence with the Clintons was to give money to this foundation. That's according to Campaign Legal Center Policy Director Meredith McGee. And while these arms deals may seem like ancient history, Lawrence Lessig, the director of Harvard University's Safra Center for Ethics, says, quote, they raise a fundamental question of judgment, one that is relevant to the 2016 presidential campaign. Can it really be that the Clintons didn't recognize the questions these transactions would raise? And if they did, what does that say about their sense of the appropriate relationship between private gain and public good? End quote. Now let us take a look at a piece from Common Dreams entitled Hillary Clinton Called Out for Hypocrisy on Islamophobia. 11 advocacy organizations last week accused former Secretary of State Clinton of sending mixed messages on Islamophobia by denouncing fellow 2016 presidential candidate Donald Trump's racist rhetoric, yet retaining retired General Wesley Clark as a campaign surrogate, despite his previous call to intern some Muslim Americans. Clark, a longtime ally to Clinton, recently spoke in Iowa on her behalf for Veterans Day. This is the same retired general who, in July interview with MSNBC, called for, quote, disloyal Americans to be placed in internment camps in the style of World War II era. Quote, if these people are radicalized and they don't support the United States and they're disloyal to the United States as a matter of principle, fine. It's their right, and it's our right and obligation to segregate them from the normal community for the duration of the conflict. Clark added, quote, if someone supported Nazi Germany at the expense of the United States, we didn't say that that was freedom of speech. We put them in a camp. They were prisoners of war. Thursday's letter argues that Clark's campaign role raises questions about Clinton's sincerity in denouncing Trump's plan to ban Muslims who are not U.S. citizens from entering the country. Echoing Clark, Trump defended his proposal by comparing it to President Franklin Roosevelt's decision to intern Japanese Americans during World War II. Quote, at a time when American Muslims are facing a surge in violent hate crimes, we're asking you to hold your own campaign accountable. States the open letter, which is signed by colorofchange.org. We are not aware of any statement from your campaign condemning General Clark's frightening remarks. Please immediately remove General Clark from his role in your campaign and promise to do the same with any campaign surrogates aiming, aiding, and abetting the dangerous anti-Muslim mob mentality fostered by your opponents. Clinton's impact on Muslims across the globe, however, extends far beyond her relationship with Clark. In her previous role as Secretary of State and U.S. Senator, Clinton consistently advocated for disastrous U.S. military aggression against Muslim-majority nations, from Afghanistan to Libya to Syria and Iraq. In addition, Clinton has made unbreakable bonds with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, an enforcer of apartheid policies towards Palestinians, a centerpiece of her 2016 presidential campaign. What's more, in a speech delivered earlier this month to the Brookings Institute, Clinton invoked the so-called War on Terror to argue for an erosion of First Amendment rights. From Clinton, quote, we're going to have some support from our friends in the technology world to deny online space. Just as we have destroyed ISIS's would-be caliphate, we have to deny them online space. And this is complicated, says Clinton, quote, you're going to hear all of the usual complaints, you know, freedom of speech, etc. But if we truly are in a war against terrorism, and we are truly looking for ways to shut off their funding, shut off the flow of foreign fighters, then we've got to shut off their means of communicating. Many have argued that the war on terror, orchestrated by Clinton and other politicians on both sides of the aisle, plays a critical role in stoking the Islamophobic and racist sentiment sweeping the United States today. In a recent piece in Intercept, Journalist Glenn Greenwald pointed out that the United States is, quote, an overwhelmingly Christian country that has spent 14 years and counting waging a relentless, seemingly endless war in predominantly Muslim countries that touts Israel as its closest ally. Numerous factions have all sorts of lurking incentives to demonize Muslims as the greatest menace, and Trump has simply become an unusually unrestrained vehicle for expressing all of that and an unusually aggressive exploiter of it. But he is not its created nor its prime mover. End quote. Now I want to share a piece on Clinton and the mess with ISIS. And this is from Jeffrey Sachs from the Huffington Post. It's entitled Hillary Clinton and the ISIS Mess. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Nall. This is a special program dealing specifically with the history of Clinton, both Bill and Hillary Clinton, more specifically Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and as a senator, and what she supported and why you should be aware of this. What you ultimately choose to do with it, support her or not, becomes your freedom of choice. But this is information that the mainstream media is not discussing. There are no debates on this. Hillary Clinton's speech on ISIS showed clearly what to expect in a Clinton presidency. More of the same. In her speech, Clinton doubled down on the existing failed U.S. approach in the Middle East, the one she pursued as Secretary of State. The CIA-led policy in the Middle East works like this. If a regime is deemed to be unfriendly to the United States, topple it. If a competitor like the Soviet Union or Russia has a foothold in a region, try to push it out. If this means arming violent insurgencies like the Sunni jihadist and thereby creating mayhem, so be it. And if the result is terrorist blowback around the world by the forces created by the U.S., then double down on bombing and regime change. In rare cases, great presidents learn to stand up to the CIA and the rest of the military-industrial intelligence complex. JFK became one of the greatest presidents in American history when he came to realize the awful truth that his own military and CIA advisors had contributed to the onset of the missile crisis in Cuba. The CIA-led Bay of Pigs fiasco and other CIA blunders had provoked a terrifying response from the Soviet Union. Recognizing that the U.S. approach had contributed to bringing the world to the brink, Kennedy bravely and successfully stood up to the warmongering pushed by so many of his advisors and pursued peace both during and after the Cuban Missile Crisis. He thereby saved the world from nuclear annihilation and halted the unchecked proliferation of nuclear arms. Clinton's speech shows that she and her advisors are good loyalists of the military-industrial intelligence complex. Her speech, including an impressive number of tactical elements, who should do the bombing and who should be the foot soldiers, yet all of this tactical precision is nothing more than business as usual. Would Clinton ever have the courage and vision to push back against U.S. security establishment, as did JFK, and thereby restore global diplomacy and reverse the upward spiral of war and terror? Just as the CIA contributed to the downward slide to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and just as many of JFK's security chiefs urged war rather than negotiating during that crisis, so too today's Middle East terrorism and wars and refugee crisis have been stoked by misguided CIA-led interventions. Starting in 1979, the CIA began to build the modern Sunni jihadist movement, then known as the Mujahideen, to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The CIA recruited young Sunni Muslim men to fight the Soviet infidel, and the CIA provided training, arms, and financing. Yet as soon enough, this U.S.-created jihadist army turned on the U.S., a classic and typical case of blowback. The anti-U.S. and anti-Western blowback started with the first Gulf War in 1990, when the U.S. stationed troops throughout the region. It continued with the second Gulf War, when the U.S. toppled a Sunni regime in Iraq and replaced it with a puppet Shia regime. In the process, a dismantled Saddam's Sunni-led army, which then regrouped as a core part of ISIS in Iraq. Next, the U.S. teamed up with Saudi Arabia to harass and then to try to topple the Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Assad's main crime, from the perspective of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, he was simply too close politically to Iran. Once again, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia turned to Sunni jihadists with arms and financing, and part of that fighting force morphed into ISIS in Syria. The evidence is that the covert U.S. actions against Assad predate the overt U.S. calls for Assad's overthrow in 2011 by at least a couple of years. In a similar vein, the U.S. teamed up with France and the United Kingdom to bomb Libya and kill Muammar Gaddafi. The result has been an ongoing Libyan civil war and the unleashing of violent jihadists across the African shale, including Mali, which suffered the terrorist blow last week at the hands of such marauders. Thanks to America's misguided policies, we now have wars and violence raging across a 5,000-mile stretch from one area of Mali to Kabul, Afghanistan, with U.S. hand in starting and stoking all of the violence. Libya, the Sudan, the Sinai, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan are all cases where the U.S. has directly intervened with very adverse results. Mali, Chad, Central African Republic, Somalia are some of the many other countries indirectly caught up in turmoil unleashed by U.S. covert and overt operations. Of course, U.S. is not solely to blame for all of this. Countries across the Horn of Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia are impoverished, suffering from food shortages and hunger, high joblessness, global warming, severe droughts, illiteracy, and the impact of dysfunctional or non-existent schools. The region still reels from the artificial borders and the cynical actions of the colonial powers, Britain and France, after World War I. The British Empire, of course, was key to entrenching radical Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, which now provides cash and ideological support for many of the Sunni jihadists. Until today, Clinton has not acknowledged the roots of the conflict in the region, including the disastrous role that the U.S. has played, including under her watch as Secretary of State. She has not been a mastermind of it, but has been a loyal backer carried along by the CIA, the broader military-industrial intelligence complex, and the conventional neocon thinking in Washington, D.C. That's no doubt good for her national politics. It's hard to run for president as an opponent of the permanent U.S. security state. Being a card-carrying member of the U.S. security establishment is the mainstream media's definition of a serious candidate. Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders are learning this from all their troubles. O'Malley and Sanders wisely and correctly support an America that works with other countries and with the UN Security Council to build peace in the Middle East, rather than an America that continues to indulge in endless and failed CIA adventures of regime change and war. And while Clinton arrogantly demands that other countries such as Russia and Iran fall squarely behind the U.S., Sanders recognizes that it is through compromise in the UN Security Council that we can defeat ISIS and find lasting solution in the Middle East. And that is a separate article. Now, also want to take a careful look at more of what we can expect from Clinton. This is a piece from Stephen Zunis from Truthout. It is entitled, What We Can Expect from Hillary Clinton on Israel-Palestine. Supporters of the international legal framework, which has, with mixed success, governed international affairs since the end of World War II, have long expressed concerns over the prospect of former Senator and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton becoming president. Her support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, a flagrant violation of the U.N. Charter, as well as her hostility towards the International Criminal Court, her support for international recognition of Morocco's illegal annexation of occupied Western Sahara, and her attacks against the United Nations and a number of its key agencies raise concerns that her election would bring a return to the Bush administration's neoconservative rejection of longstanding international legal principles. One of the big challenges regarding the application of international law is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which involves a foreign belligerent occupation, illegal colonization, war crimes committed by both the occupying power and at least one arm of the resistance, and scores of UN Security Council resolutions. As senator, and subsequently, Hillary Clinton has developed a reputation as one of the most right-wing Democrats on Israel-Palestine, repeatedly siding with Likud-led governments against Israeli progressives and moderates, and taking a dismissive attitude regarding the application of international law or any role for the United Nations. As a senator, Clinton defended Israel's colonization efforts in the occupied West Bank and was highly critical of the United Nations for its efforts to uphold international humanitarian law, which forbids transferring civilian populations onto territories under foreign belligerent occupation. Clinton criticized UN's enforcement of four United Nations Security Council resolutions calling on Israel to end the practice. It even took the time for a 2005 visit to a major Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank in a show of support. She moderated that stance somewhat as Secretary of State in expressing concerns over how the right-wing Israeli government settlement policies harmed the overall climate of peace process, but she has refused to acknowledge the illegality of the settlements or demand that Israel abide by international demands to stop building additional settlements. Subsequently, she has argued that the Obama administration pushed too hard in the early years of the administration to get Israel to suspend settlement construction. In 2011, Clinton successfully pushed for a U.S. veto of UN Security Council resolution reiterating the illegality of the settlement drive and calling for a settlement freeze. The UN Security Council has traditionally been the vehicle for enforcing international law on territories under foreign belligerent occupation. But Clinton noted, quote, "We have consistently over many years said the United Nations Security Council and resolutions that would come before the Security Council is not the right vehicle to advise and advance that goal, despite U.S. failure to stop this colonization drive on its own. Moreover, when the Netanyahu government in Israel reneged on an earlier promise of a temporary and limited freeze and announced massive subsidies for the construction of new settlements on the eve of her 2011 visit to Israel, Clinton spoke only of the need for peace talks to resume. She even equated Palestinians' legal right to have their state recognized by the United Nations with Israel's illegal settlements policy as undermining the peace process. Clinton has insisted, quote, "We will not deal with nor in any way fund a Palestinian government that includes Hamas unless and until Hamas has renounced violence, recognized Israel, and agreed to follow the previous obligations to the Palestinian Authority." However, Clinton has called for increasing U.S. military aid and diplomatic support for Israel's right-wing government, which includes ministers from far-right-wing parties who support violent settler militias that have repeatedly attacked Palestinian civilians. They oppose recognition of a Palestinian state, and they reject the Oslo Agreement and subsequent agreements by Israeli government. More recently, Clinton has been making a series of excuses as to why Israel cannot make peace, despite the showing authorities' acquiescence to virtually all of the demands made by the Obama administration. For example, the Washington Post noted how, quote, "she appeared to blame the collapse of direct Israeli-Palestinian talks on the wave of Middle East revolutions and unrest until 2011 Arab Spring, although talks had broken off the previous year," end quote. Clinton has also said that Israelis cannot be expected to make peace until they, quote, "know what happens in Syria, whether Jordan will remain stable, which most observers recognize will take a very long time, thereby enabling Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to further colonize the West Bank to the point where the establishment of a viable Palestinian state is impossible. What kind of peace settlement she envisions has not been made clear, but she did endorse former Israeli Prime Minister Sharon's 2004 convergence plan, which would have allowed Israel to annex large areas of Palestinian territory conquered by Israeli forces in the 1976 war. Despite the longstanding principle in international law against any country expanding its territory by force, and the fact that it would divide any future Palestinian state into a series of small, non-contiguous cantons surrounded by Israel. She has vigorously defended Israel's wars on Gaza. As Secretary of State, she took the lead in attempting to block any action by the United Nations in response to a 2009 report by UN Human Rights Council fact-finding mission headed by the distinguished South African jurist Richard Goldstone and a Zionist Jew, which documented war crimes by both Israel and Hamas. She has implied that the report, quote, denied Israel's right to self-defense, when in fact it explicitly recognized Israel's right to do so, since the report's only objections to Israel's conduct were in regard to attacks on civilian targets, not its military actions against extremist militia lobbing rockets into Israel. It appears that either she was deliberately misrepresenting the report, neither bothering to read it, but attacking it, or believes killing civilians can constitute legitimate self-defense. More recently, in response to concerns raised by Israel and International Human Rights Group about the nearly 1,500 civilians killed by Israeli forces during the 2014 war on the Gaza Strip, she insisted, quote, I think Israel need what it had to do to respond to Hamas rockets. Israel has a right to defend itself. When Israeli forces attacked UN school housing refugees in the Gaza Strip in July of 2014, killing dozens of civilians, the Obama administration issued a statement saying it was appalled by the disgraceful shelling. By contrast, Hillary Clinton, when pressed about it during an interview with The Atlantic Monthly, refused to criticize the massacre, saying, quote, it's impossible to know what happens in the fog of war. Though investigators found no evidence of Hamas equipment or military activity anywhere near the school, Clinton falsely alleged that they were firing rockets from an annex in the school. In any case, she argued, when Palestinian civilians die from Israeli attacks, quote, the ultimate responsibility has to rest with Hamas and the decisions it made. Though President Obama has provided more aid to Israel than any previous U.S. administration and taken a number of other unprecedented steps in support of Israel, Clinton has criticized him for being too critical of Israel's right-wing government. In response to the chilly relationship between Obama and Netanyahu, she has promised to invite the right-wing Israeli prime minister to the White House within a month of coming to office. She has rejected taking a position of tough love advocated by Israeli moderates and Israeli liberals, and says that any disagreements with Israel policy should be done only, quote, in private and behind, you know, closed doors, end quote. On the grounds otherwise, it opens the door to everyone else to delegitimize Israel. In Clinton's view, then, supporting Israel moderates by publicly opposing efforts to undermine the peace process and ongoing violations of international humanitarian law by the country's right-wing government is the same as delegitimizing the nation itself. And since under her leadership, the State Department formally listed efforts to delegitimize Israel as part of a definition of anti-Semitism, it may give some indication of how her administration would characterize those who do publicly raise concerns regarding certain Israeli policy. And goes much further, but that gives you an idea. Also, there is another piece, and this is from Eve Smith from Naked Capitalism. The article is entitled Another Hillary Falsehood. She did not tell banks to cut it out pre-crisis. She blamed homeowners. Quote, I knew this was untrue the minute I heard it because no one in Congress told banks to cut it out. Foreclosures even when the crisis got much worse. And least of all, a blue dog Democrat who represents Wall Street and became senator here as opposed to the more logical Illinois with the intent of currying favor with him. Concerned congressmen were pleading with regulators and making legislative proposals like for a new homeowners loan corporation modeled on a successful depression model. After Obama made it clear he was all in with supporting the banks as much as he could, and as far as March 2009, there was not much ground for making a case to the banks directly. But Clinton didn't simply pretend to do something she didn't. She abjectly falsified her history In the debate, she said she went to Wall Street in December 2007. That much she did do. But rather than get tough with financial firms, as she claimed, she went with the, quote, everyone's to blame line, which of course means no one is to blame except for those greedy homeowners. And yes, this speech was made in December 2007, and she starts by praising Wall Street and saying how important it is that Wall Street remain cutting edge, indeed, quote, the global capital of finance, but she then suggests that there's a we problem and that not everybody is sharing in the prosperity it creates. This is as strong as she gets in criticizing financier. Quote, but finally, responsibility also belongs to Wall Street, which not only enable but often encourage reckless mortgage lending. Wall Street may not have created the foreclosure crisis, but Wall Street certainly had a hand in making it worse. And in the very next line, she started walking it back. Quote, we also must recognize, though, that the good things have happened in the housing market. Home ownership is at the heart of the American dream, and ownership rates rose to a record 69% in 2006. And then she gave bromides about how this was all complicated, way too complicated, and that big finance needed to go along voluntarily with some proposals of hers, which had she bothered to investigate how securitization worked, she would have known some could not have been implemented. So once again, she lied. This is from David Sirota from International Business Times. Quote, Hillary Clinton gets $13 million from health industry. Says no single payer will, quote, ever, never come to pass. Closing out her Iowa campaign, Hillary Clinton declared that the Medicare for All proposal pushed by her Democratic primary opponent, many liberal groups, will, quote, never, ever come to pass, end quote. The statement came weeks after a new poll showed most Americans support the idea. Her declaration was a reversal of her position 2 decades ago, which came before she received millions of dollars of campaign cash from the health industry. Clinton's comments, which were made during an appearance at the Grandview University in Iowa, were aimed at Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who had long championed the kind of government administrative health care system used by many major industrialized nations. Of Sanders' proposal, Clinton said, quote, people who have health emergencies can't wait for us to have a theoretical debate about some better idea that will never, ever come to pass. About the Kaiser Family Foundation's December 15, 2000 tracking found 50% of Americans support expanding Medicare for covering everyone, meaning single payer. Clinton slammed the push for single payer, even though some of the major labor unions supporting her campaign have long cited that goal as a top legislative priority. Her comments also contrast with what she herself said in 1994 remarks to the Lehman Brothers Health Corporation. As CBS News notes, back then she declared that a single-payer system was all but inevitable, saying, quote, I believe that by the year 2000 we will have a single-payer system. I don't think it's a close call politically. It will be such a huge popular issue in the sense of populist issues that even if it's not successful the first time, it will eventually be, end quote. Between that declaration and her now saying single payer can never pass, Clinton has vacuumed in roughly $13 million from sources in the health sector, according to data compiled by the nonpartisan Center for Responsible Politics. And that includes $11.2 million from the sector when Clinton was a senator and $2 million from health industry sources during her 2016 presidential campaign. A 2006 story about her relationship with the health industry. The New York Times notes that during her Senate re-election campaign, she was, quote, receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from doctors, hospitals, drug manufacturers, and insurers, and had become, quote, the number two recipient of donations from the industry. Intercept also reported that from 2013 to 2015, Clinton received more than $2.8 million in speaking fees from the medical industrial complex. Clinton and her daughter Chelsea have suggested Sanders would dismantle the Affordable Care Act, which Sanders voted for. Sanders has disputed that and has stated that if passed, single-payer system is impossible unless the president pushes for it. So that's the latest on that. Now, there are many issues, probably another 20 major articles I have not had a chance to review with you, including Hillary's The Hawk and Her Middle East Policies, a long piece that is posted on our website. In fact, we have about 25 additional articles posted on our website for you to be able to review at your leisure. This is just to give you some idea that whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, she's going to support Israel. With war around the world, she will support every war everywhere because she has consistently, working in secret with the military-industrial complex, the intelligence complex, the CIA. Those are her friends. That's who she works with. Working with big banks, she loves the big banks. Working with arms dealers, she loves arms dealers. She loves selling arms to dealers. Without any compunction or any qualification, what will ultimately happen to these weapons? Who will they be used against? From looking at the people who've been adversely affected in Iraq, Yemen, in Libya, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yugoslavia, that was her husband's war and hers as well. Is this what you want? She supports genetically engineering of food. She's a big supporter of Monsanto. She was on the board of Walmart. And she has not been a friend of the average worker or unions. She's a big supporter of outsourcing jobs, as was her husband around the world. She does not believe in repealing the Glass-Steagall Act. She does not believe in regulations of Wall Street. She would sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all of the treaties, therefore completely destroying all sovereignty in the United States and all of the hard-won regulations that protect the people over the last 50 years. Then you must ask, how is it possible that if I can come up with all this information, all credible, all from respected sources, why couldn't the Wall Street Journal, why couldn't the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and others? They could, therefore they're in alignment with her. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for listening.